Hey, everyone. Today's book is on public speaking by a man so skilled at public speaking, he's constantly picturing you naked. It's Talk Like TED by Carmine Gallo.
I'm Kellett Erskine. I'm a comic, a father, and after 50 episodes of this podcast, we've finally reached one where I am more of an expert than the author on this subject, and boy, does it feel great.
And I'm David Vance. I'm a writer who spends almost every day alone in my bedroom typing, so I can't wait to teach you how to do public speaking. Talk Like TED gives lessons in public speaking from TED Talks, which were a much bigger deal when the book came out. You may like the author's other book about Furbies.
And this is The Book Pile.
All right, a little reminder about rating and reviewing. Just remember, you don't want to be on your deathbed thinking, I wish I'd told that podcast how I feel.
Got a review from a listener named JZW12, which is, I'm assuming is their license plate. And they say, high-minded humor. Thanks.
We should leave them a review that says, brief. Thanks.
All right, just another quick but very important reminder that we're doing our first live recording of The Book Pile on October 29th, All Hallows Eve, at the Comedy Club Improv Broadway in Provo, Utah. Go to improvbroadway.com for tickets, 15 online, 20 at the door. It's going to sell out. I'm going to do some stand-up. We're going to do the podcast. We'll do a Q&A where you can ask me about my stand-up. And remember, bring any random book with you and we will sign it at the end.
Finally, our next two books are The Two Towers and Physics of the Impossible. But whatever, I know it's possible for Legolas to grab the undersaddle of a fully running horse, flip himself vertically with one hand, and land perfectly on its back. Shut up, scientists. Do you remember that moment?
Yes. There's also a moment in the last of the Hobbit movies, A Battle of the Five Armies, where there are rocks free falling off of a cliff and Legolas runs up the falling rocks, just like how Tolkien described it.
I love the idea of original authors who would absolutely hate the way their work was adapted. Like how the author of Mary Poppins hated how Mary Poppins the movie turned out, and then Disney turned around and made a movie about how much she loved how Mary Poppins turned out.
All right, without any further ado, here are our five favorite lessons from Talk Like TED. All right, lesson one, watch yourself. What if we just ended it there and it just sounds like a threat? So record yourself, watch yourself, and when you can't, then at least hit the voice memo app and record yourself. This to me is the most important of all the steps at improving at public speaking. With all the other tidbits that you can be taught about, you know, staying on message and keeping things brief and telling concrete stories, the best way to improve is just to see how bad you are up there. I learned this early on in a college speech class, and I'm saying early on because I went to college early. So,
how old were you when you graduated?
Oh, man. Because I haven't graduated, everyone. That's the joke. I started when I was 13, still haven't finished. Anyway, speech
class. Can someone flunk out of the School of Hard Knocks?
The point of all that is that I had a college speech instructor. She had us bring blank VHS tapes so that she could record us for ourselves to watch. And it was awful. And she told all of us that it would be, and she was right. And the crazy thing, too, is to me, especially after speaking, after now having done it for, you know, over a decade, we gave three big speeches during one semester and recorded ourselves three times. And the end of the class was supposed to be like, now watch that third tape of yourself. See how much you've improved? it takes hundreds of times. And nobody wants to hear that.
It is crazy just what a good feedback loop can do. Like, if you can bake a good feedback loop into your life, it's nuts how it can change your behavior. So, for instance, you know those blinking speed limit signs?
Yeah.
they came to that conclusion after they tried so many different things, speed traps or clearly posted speed limit signs. And the thing that worked better than any of them was just a feedback loop that says, here's what you're supposed to be doing, here's what you're actually doing, and it blinks to bother you until you get in line.
Huh. I wish they had those for people who take off their shoes on airplanes.
It's okay because I wear a mask on my feet. I hang out around a lot of actors, and I do have this theory about why experienced actors are often so charismatic. I think a big part of it is they just see hours and hours of footage of themselves, so they know how they come across in a ton of different scenarios. Mm.
The biggest lesson for me in public speaking was that I learned that I do not look how I think I look when I'm talking. One thing I would say about that food back loop, Evan, can you tell I'm intermittently fasting? One thing that I'll say about the feedback loop is that it only helps to a point to have like friends and family critique you. At one point in the book, he says to have friends and colleagues watch your speech and have them give open, honest feedback, which first of all, no one fully does. And most of what you need to improve will be self-evident. So anything you want to change about yourself and your own like physicality and body language, you can learn by just watching what you don't like and changing it. So when I first started recording myself, the first things that I noticed is that I would look down at the stage a lot instead of at the audience. My face looked perpetually serious, even when I didn't think that it did. Also, I had a tendency to kick my shoes off into the faces of the closest audience members. That was just a nervous habit I wasn't aware of until I rolled the tape back. So all the other stuff. So I would say trust in your own self-correction rather than going to people for stage presence. You know how you want to look and you know how you actually look when you watch yourself. You can make monumental corrections very quickly just by watching yourself as if you're an audience member. Another one that I forgot to mention is I noticed this one thing where if I walk on stage and grab the mic out of the stand without looking at the mic or the stand, just staring at the crowd while I did it, it comes across immediately as this like gesture of authority. Like when you watch someone play the guitar without looking, like it's almost an unconscious thing to be like, all right, now I'm in charge.
I own the room.
I'm still, yeah. And even though it took me 5 years to get over stage fright, but I found that by doing those things, by being aware of these gestures and appearing comfortable, that the audience is then comfortable with me.
Hmm. That's why at the beginning of every podcast, Kellen and I assemble our entire mic setup while staring straight at the computer. Okay, lesson two. Deliver jaw-dropping moments. Unless you're the guy at the morgue whose job is to carry the jaws. So he starts by telling a little story. Bill Gates is giving this TED Talk about fighting malaria. And I looked it up, and true to form, it has the ugliest graphics. He really walks the Microsoft talk. So he's talking about malaria, and as an attention getter, in the middle of his speech, he opens up a container and releases mosquitoes into the room. And he says, there's no reason only poor people should have the experience. So the author points out that mosquito moment is the part of the speech everyone remembers. It's a jaw-dropping moment, meaning a moment so shocking or impressive or memorable that you remember it years later. He tells another story. This woman, Jill Bolte Taylor, is giving a TED Talk about neuroscience. And to be attention-grabbing, she brings out someone's actual human brain, which... First off, I'm sure people remembered, but also wouldn't that be so sad that you donate your body to science and you get used as a magic trick? I'd be like, oh, couldn't you have just led with the Webster's Dictionary thing?
I hope that person's epitaph read something like, my body's here, but my brain is racking up views on YouTube.
Have you ever heard what happened to Einstein's brain?
No.
So Einstein dies. His pathologist removes his brain, dissects it, keeps most of it. And he does not seem to have anyone's permission to do any of this. Whoa. He also removes Einstein's eyes and gives them to his ophthalmologist, you know, like a present. And then He keeps the brain stored in a cider box for years. He had like preservatives and things, but it's just sitting in a cider box. Apparently, at one point, his wife wanted to throw it out. Finally, this journalist tracks him down 20 years later and is like, do you have Einstein's brain? And the guy's like, yeah. He pulls it out of the cider box, and that's how the world found out where it was. And also, later, he lost his medical license for failing an exam.
Oh, man. I wish that the world would have found out about his brain by the guy, like, showing up on Antique Roadshow.
Anyway, all this to say, in your speech, you know, try to figure out what's the jaw-dropping moment I deliver.
Another TED speaker, neuroscientist Gregory Burns, said, "The brain is a lazy piece of meat," which is just a horrible new way to think of this thing that you've been told is amazing your whole life. Mm-hmm. He says, "The brain must be provided with something that it has never before processed to force it out of its predictable perceptions." And going back to the Bill Gates TED Talk, like the predictable perception of all of their TED Talks before it is that the speaker wouldn't release insects into the crowd.
I like, too, that the joke of that Bill Gates thing is it's like, oh, do these have malaria? Ha ha, no, they don't. But they're still mosquitoes. If someone, as a prank, pretends to inject you with heroin, they still stabbed you with a needle.
Did he get, like, what he thought were random applause breaks, and it's just people slapping themselves? All right. Lesson 3. Enthusiasm isn't as important as this book says it is. And I'm not just saying this because I'm not an enthusiastic person.
About anything.
I'm saying this as someone who has done public speaking literally thousands of times. And also someone who's a fan of TED Talks. So I'm not discrediting enthusiasm. I just think that passion is more important, and the two words aren't necessarily synonyms. Like, some of the most compelling TED Talks I've watched are from speakers like Sami Mukadem, who deal with chronic depression, and their talks can be moving, hopeful, and passionate in their own way. Like, you can tell that they care about this subject, despite the fact that they're not, like, high-fiving people in the front row. So I think whether it's a stand-up set, a speech, or a presentation, the goal should be to have compelling material plus a comfortable onstage presence in that order of priority. I think comfortable should be your default goal for stage presence. I think that this guy's got causation mixed up in the book. It's like he looks for patterns but ignores the bigger picture. Like, he'll find TED Talks from energetic speakers, talks that have millions of views. And by the way, he'll tell you how many million views each talk gets. That's a big thing for him.
Yeah, it's important not to date your book.
So he'll find these, like, 3 TED Talks from energetic speakers and then say that you have to be energetic to give a good talk. And to me, that would be like watching the first Star Wars trilogy and saying that a good movie needs spaceships.
Like, which, to be fair, you could make a good case.
Okay, that was a bad example.
Name any movie that's not improved by spaceships. No,
that's true. Driving Miss Daisy would have been a lot more fun. Flight 93. So it just looks like he's looking for this, like he wants this to be the case. At one point he says, "Watching an enthusiastic speaker is as refreshing as drinking ice cold water in the desert." I don't even know what that means. It's like, yeah, I know what refreshing means.
You know, hearing a good metaphor is like eating a delicious strawberry.
Yeah, it's just, you're not explaining anything. So watching someone who's enthusiastic, it can be fun. I argue only if that person is naturally enthusiastic, but also being enthusiastic doesn't equal compelling. So I'm gonna list some enthusiastic things and some unenthusiastic things, and you tell me which ones are more compelling. So here are some enthusiastic things: a great home security salesman, a frat party, that one movie based on the board game Battleship. Here are some unenthusiastic things. Some things that, by Carmen Gallo's standards, are unenthusiastic and thus boring. Captain Jack Sparrow, The Grapes of Wrath, James Taylor. So to me, the point is you can be energetic and still boring, but you can also be calm and compelling if you're more laid back by nature. But it's a misconception to think that energy equals entertaining. Like, have you ever been to a timeshare presentation?
My great uncle actually made his money in timeshares. Careful.
I was invited to one once because I lied about my income on one of those raffle tickets to win a sports car at the mall. That's all that those are there for. Because I always filled those out, and one time I wrote down that I made over $250,000 a year. This is 10 years ago, so don't judge me. So I got invited to this timeshare presentation and drove my little like Scion hatchback to it.
I have 12 of these.
And then I still got 3 free days at any timeshares in the country just for being at the presentation. And that's what, wow, I walked away with. So
just for being there as a false rich person.
At one point, he says, quote, "Great speakers are animated when they speak. They do not stand in one spot or remain motionless." Since he's so into basing success on how many YouTube views people have, I just want to let everyone know that my dry bar special currently has almost 5 million views, and I just stand in one place the whole time.
And where can we find it?
On YouTube, or for $3 on Amazon Prime, Dave. That being said, I do move around a little bit more now because I found I feel and I look more comfortable if I'm at least turning from side to side.
In the podcast, he is walking constantly.
But I still don't leave like that 3-foot radius. The first open mic that I ever did was at the San Jose Improv. It's this beautiful, historic, big, like 500-seat theater where icons like Harry Houdini performed there. And at, wow, the time, I was brand new at comedy. I thought that stand-up comedians paced the stage, you know, and complained about stuff. So I did, and halfway through my set, I tripped over the mic cord.
Oh, no.
And it was the biggest laugh that I got.
Oh, no. So did you incorporate that? Like,
so yeah, my takeaway is pretend that you're rich and you'll get crazy free stuff. So if you are natural enthusiastic, that's great. If you're not, don't try to be.
You're embarrassing yourself.
Just try to appear comfortable and the audience will be comfortable with you. We love Gary Goldman's quote about stage presence, which is to learn to be yourself, but on purpose.
Okay, lesson 4, use humor. So he starts by talking about the most popular TED Talk of all time. It's "Do Schools Kill Creativity" by Ken Robinson, who actually passed away last year. Oh, man. I assume killed by schools.
Humor.
Anyway, Ken Robinson, super funny talk. And the author points out, you know, humor was a big part of what made the talk successful for a couple reasons. He says humor lowers people's defenses and it also makes you more likable. And I would add humor also gets people's attention. At the ad agency, you know, we say a joke is a Trojan horse that smuggles in information. I also think humor can salvage things where people can be like, well, I didn't agree, but at least it was funny. Kind of the Dave Chappelle principle. Mm-hmm. Anyway, but then the author turns around and says that the most popular speakers don't tell jokes. They tell amusing anecdotes. And I watched the talk. Ken Robinson tells so many jokes. Mm-hmm. So I don't know where the author is getting this like commandment from. This even goes further than what you're saying. He takes one example and then gives a rule that goes immediately contra that example.
The only way that this makes sense to me, and I still don't agree with it, I think he's talking about like street jokes, like a priest, a rabbi, and an atheist are on a plane. Because he says most popular TED speakers do not tell jokes. Unless you're a professional comedian, jokes are not authentic. A humorous observation, however, is very effective. And I'm like, that's what a joke is. What are you talking about? If I'm coming from a professional comedian, I've never like told a joke in my life, if that's what he's talking about. Like if he's
right.
Like,
you think when Seinfeld tells a rabbi goes into a bar joke that he hasn't practiced it?
Yeah, that's what he said.
He hones his dumb blonde material over countless repetitions.
You know how Bill Burr is one of the few people who can pull off a great knock-knock joke on Netflix?
I will say, if you are going to crack a joke in the speech, really test it on a few audiences and make sure that they actually laugh. Because as he's saying, it's terrible to, you know, bomb, especially in a speech. But I also find in public speaking, the bar for a funny joke is way lower than in like stand-up.
Right. Yeah.
Like if Ken Robinson had given his speech at an open mic, he would not have done super well.
Yeah, I would say to anyone who's going to read this book, you can just listen to this podcast because Dave said everything that is helpful about humor. Just go ahead and ignore chapter 6 of this book because it's a chapter about humor from a guy who has examined it from a distance and is like giving us his best guesses really confidently. Because the rest of that quote that you started, I agree with the first part, humor lowers defenses. But then the rest of it says, quote, which makes the audience more receptive to your message. It also makes you likable and people are more willing to do business with someone whom they like. And at that point, I was like, wait, that's the point of this book? Like the author just rips off his mask and it's Dale Carnegie. And he's 140.
We need some kind of shorthand for the impulse to take anything good or virtuous or enjoyable and try to monetize it. Yeah. All right, random facts. So I like his point about jaw-dropping moments. But I also like that he follows it with such a boring sentence. He says, an emotionally charged event, usually called an ECS, short for emotional competent stimulus, is the best processed kind of external stimulus ever measured, says molecular scientist John Medina. I love so much that that line made it into a book about memorable communication.
I like that he has a chapter where he talks about what he calls the 18-minute rule, which just says is the most effective amount of time to speak if you want people to remember your message. And in the audiobook, it takes him 35 minutes to explain.
So I thought this was a useful tip. He says, before giving a talk, you know, ask yourself, what's the one thing I want my audience to remember? And then make sure that that one thing is short enough to fit in a tweet. Kind of going back to that principle, you know, you say 10 things, you say nothing. And Kellen, you've talked about the ad clients who are like, all right, our core message is that we're cheap and high quality and good for the environment and good customer service and we give back.
Yeah, I mean, it is crazy. Sometimes I'll read a book and walk away with one idea from it.
Yeah, and it can be worth it if it's a really good idea.
Absolutely. I made a note for this one that where I just put bad science, bad quote, bad person. At one point in the book, like this is like reminiscent of the Why We Sleep episode. He just says, brain scans show that stories stimulate the brain, making the audience more likely to agree with the speaker's point of view. So he starts with an uncited scientific study and then just adds his opinion after the comma.
He's telling a story hoping that you will be more likely to agree.
Because I agree that stories are good, but you can't just like make up things. That's like before Google, this is what middle school was like. people would just say stuff like, yeah, don't swallow gum or it'll stay in your stomach for 7 years. And then all of us just believed it until the internet came around.
My brother Johnny, one time in elementary school, the flag was at half mast and the kids were wondering why. And he told someone that it was because President Bush was dying. And by the end of the day, it had spread to the whole school. Someone was raising money for President Bush. And then he said there were weapons of mass.
At one point in the book, he says, eliminate cliches and buzzwords. Then later in the chapter, he says, quote, I believe the only courage anybody ever really needs is the courage to follow their own dreams. Which not only is cliche, but it really isn't true. Like, I think it probably takes more courage to escape with your family from a war-torn country. Not just like quitting school to become a YouTuber.
Wasn't it FDR who said, we have nothing to fear but not being fully authentic?
So as much as I rag on the book, there are a lot of helpful things in this book. It was just sort of an obstacle course for me of sort of trying to step through the unuseful stuff. So I can't say that I fully recommend this book. There are other public speaking books that I would go to before this book, like Do You Talk Funny by Dave Nihil. That was an episode that we did early on. And he is he's another stand-up comic storyteller who gives, to me, a more concise, effective list of public speaking tips. I do like the emphasis that the author puts on stories. When public speaking, you can never go wrong with a good story. I like he quotes Brené Brown, who says, stories are just data with a soul. Hmm. Here's a quick story I love from a TED Talk speaker who I don't remember at the moment, who said, sales tripled when the Silk soy milk company started putting their product in the refrigerated section next to the milk. It doesn't need to be refrigerated. And that is a concise 9-second story about Silk's marketing strategy.
It does remind me of, I think it was Balaji Srinivasan who talked about how new mediums often have to like mimic the old medium. So for instance, the first movies, they were basically just plays, but filmed. Or desktop computers had to mimic an actual desk. So I like that Silk soy milk has to pretend as much as possible to be milk.
At the end of this entire book, where he's given all of these tips and going like way too far into even how you should try and be conscious about like the speed of your speaking, the pitch, the pauses, every aspect of your speech that you should be aware of and develop and practice and organize. He ends the entire book with, once you've crafted your speech, it's time to let go and speak from the heart. It's like, no, there's a reason you crafted this whole thing and timed it down to 18 minutes. Like every word is there for a reason. Stick to the teleprompter.
I don't know, Kellen. I think maybe the only courage you need is the courage to follow your heart. It sounds like someone needs a song. When you don't follow your... All right, to recap, our favorite lessons from Talk Like TED. 1, watch yourself. 2, deliver jaw-dropping moments. 3, enthusiasm isn't as important as this book says it is. 4, use humor.
And 5, don't let that soy milk trick you.